Hey everyone, we're live with our newest episode of The Conversation. I'm your host, Elisha Krauss, and our very own Ben Shapiro will be taking live questions for an entire hour. So please remember, our conversation is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber to The Daily Wire. Subscribe to dailywire.com now and join us. And be sure to tune in for the next month's episode featuring our very own Andrew Klavan on Tuesday, April 10th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. We promise we'll try our very best to start on time. Ben just takes forever to get done with hair and makeup, and it's all his fault.
Yeah, that's the problem, Elisha. That's the big one. Yep. Yep, probably that.
Exactly that, right? Why aren't you wearing green?
Because I don't partake in this treacherous stereotyping of the Irish.
But we're on your set and it's all green.
Shut up.
Aren't you the boss around here?
Wow, I wasn't expecting this kind of grilling from my
saying,
own employee.
We're waiting for...
My goodness.
We're just waiting for...
I come in here
the,
just get abused by my own employees.
We're just waiting for the questions to pour in, so I have to fill time and I have to chit-chat with you about things.
So I know, that's always so
I
awkward. Okay,
well,
fine, so now I'm going to tell a story about my daughter because
yes.
we have nothing else to talk about.
Yes.
So before I was so rudely interrupted by staff telling me it had to be silent on set, okay, I was telling you a story of what my daughter did yesterday because she's an adorable person. So
uh-huh.
she's 4 years old and she's simultaneously brilliant as well as evil. So she takes
so
after
like you.
Her father. Correct. So I was
she's
very proud
cuter,
of her.
Though.
She's a very cute person. So she had her violin lesson yesterday
uh-huh.
and my dad has a habit of taking her to ice cream after her violin lesson every time. And so she finishes, I had to take her yesterday, my dad's out of town. So I took her to her violin lesson and afterwards she says, I want ice cream. And I said, well, we need to go home and get your brother. And then mommy will come home later and maybe we'll go for ice cream then.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to go to Menchie's, which is a frozen yogurt place out here in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And so she,
my daughter is also a fan.
Exactly. And so I said, mommy's going to come home and mommy will bring ice cream. So mommy was coming home from her doctoring and she brought home some
the hot
ice
doctoring.
Yes. Well,
yeah.
I mean, this goes without saying. And she brought home ice cream bars and my daughter says, well, what if I don't like those ice cream bars and I'd prefer Menchie's? And I said, well, then you can tell me and then maybe we'll go to Menchie's afterwards. So we get home. She opens the ice cream bar, she eats the entire thing, and then she turns to me and she goes, I didn't like any of that. And I was like, that's my girl right there.
Smart.
Like how she manipulates the system.
So what did you do?
I gave her as much ice cream as she could eat.
Now, are I told you
serious? No, of course not. I told her she'd already
like,
had an ice cream bar.
Yeah.
What do you think I am? Some sort of parental monster?
I'm just saying.
Oh, what you know, do you? How dare you?
You started the story complimenting her.
Right.
So I thought that maybe, you know, her wit got the best of you.
She did not get rewarded for being a terrible person.
Okay.
But she did get rewarded for her brilliance by life when she's rich.
And you will share that story at her wedding one day.
Yeah, presumably.
So are you like my husband in that we have two daughters? You have a son and a daughter.
Correct.
And obviously you parent a daughter differently than a son.
Yes.
And you kind of feel about them differently because it's a girl.
Yeah. Boys are crazy.
Hashtag, you know, not very politically correct right now. But... So, my husband will get very mad if I mention their wedding day.
Oh, I don't really get mad about that.
It makes him mad and sad all at the same time.
She's not old enough for that yet. When she gets a little bit older, then I'll get ticked off about it, I'm sure. But
yeah.
Right now, not so much. For him, I just give him stuff to do all day until he falls asleep. That's basically...
That's the goal.
Yeah, it's exactly like if I were actually President Trump's handler, I'd have the same plan for him that I have
and take
for
the
my
phone.
Son. Yeah, exactly. My son doesn't have a phone. The president wouldn't have a phone. And then you just schedule him all day. And then
all day long.
Right, exactly. And the president could do like nice and cute things. It'd be great.
So let's start speaking of the president. It's a revolving door over there.
Yeah, that's true. Today was a good revolving door, though.
You're
Rex
happy
Tillerson,
with the Tillerson
Yeah,
now?
Tillerson was terrible. They never should have selected Tillerson in the first place.
And are you happy with Pompeo?
Yeah, I like Pompeo. So
okay.
I think that it was very amusing to watch as the entire left, which suggested that Trump had been colluding with Russia when he hired Tillerson because Tillerson's close with Putin. Now when he fires Tillerson, they say this is also colluding with Russia.
Yeah.
So everything's collusion with Russia. It's an unfalsifiable thesis. It's pretty astonishing.
And so you tune into Fox News this morning and you hear that the news head of the CIA is like amazing and wonderful. And then you tune into CNN and you hear talking heads over there saying it's awful, she's horrible, she's okay with torture.
Right.
Where do you fall on it?
So I don't mind torture, so that's not a problem for me.
But torture of only bad guys.
Right. No, generally people. It's mostly...
Good, because sitting here is torture.
Yeah, I know. But I pay you for it. So that's the way that works.
Yeah.
Okay, so here is the deal with that. So
yep.
When it comes to the discussion of torture, it's about enhanced interrogation techniques for use on terrorists. Okay, the
mm-hmm.
whole purpose of the Geneva Convention is not to prevent torture of people who are specifically hiding among the civilian population. It's to ensure that people who actually garb themselves in uniforms are not tortured. Mm-hmm. The idea being that you want to force soldiers into uniforms so they don't hide among civilians, so you don't have to kill civilians when you're fighting soldiers. Mm-hmm. The problem with terrorists is that they hide among civilians, and so they should not be held to the same standards under the Geneva Convention so that we create a deterrent effect for people who are attempting to meld into the civilian population.
So you're okay with the new nominee for, or new CIA director?
Yeah, she's like, fine. She seems good, yeah, and I don't have a problem with her.
Okay, sorry guys, we have a problem with the system, but we never fear, we have some questions from the mailbag that we're going to roll through that you haven't answered before. From Lucas, he says, is the idea of God having a plan for the future not directly undermining of the idea of free will?
So the answer is no, in that this is obviously a question that is constantly asked by religious philosophers. Mm-hmm. If God is omniscient and omnipotent, then do you have free will? And the idea in Judaism is that God has limited his intervention in the universe in order to provide for that free will. Now, God can have knowledge of the future because God exists outside of time. So when we think of time, we tend to think of time linearly, right? This is how C.S. Lewis describes it. Mm-hmm. He says that we tend to think of time as in, like, there's today, there's tomorrow, there's the day after. But God doesn't exist in that timeline. So for God, it is always what Lewis says, the eternal present. So when we say that God knows what's going to happen to us, it means that God knows what's happening in the moment that is the future. It doesn't mean that God is sitting there and he's saying, okay, well, 3 days from now, somebody's going to plot. Instead, it is when that 3 days, God is already existing in that time because God exists outside of time.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel
it's
like
a little complex, but that's the basic
Do
notion.
You feel like Lewis, because you just mentioned him, is one of the ones that describes that the best?
Yeah, his description in Mere Christianity of the free will versus seeing the future problem is quite good.
Okay. Charles wants to know, you talk about the morality of capitalism. It's a view with which he strongly agrees. However, how would you describe the perfect balance between capitalism and entitlement spending, including Medicare, Medicaid, disability, unemployment, etc.? To expand a bit via example, take someone born with a severe disability. The cost can financially cripple a family. What kind of safety net should be in place as a in this capitalist world?
Right. So I've said it many times. One of the big problems with government intervention into these systems, that government rarely stays confined to helping the widows and the orphans. Mm-hmm. Social Security was originally designed specifically for widows and orphans, and obviously now it encompasses 1/3 of the American net spending on mm-hmm. on services. So, well, on everything, actually. It's 1/3 of the budget. So the main social safety net should be first your family, then your community, then your larger community, and then the state. Mm-hmm. So one of the big problems now is that we've reversed the polarity. People don't actually go to their family before they go to the state. Once they lose their job, they don't go to their family for loans or sleep on their couch. They instead go down to the welfare office because the state has created this barrier. Well, once the state is there taking care of these problems, people stop being as charitable, they stop being as giving. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there has to be something for people who can't take care of themselves, children, the mentally ill, people who are who have serious physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. But the state never limits it to that. The state, because they understand that there's a lot of political hay to be made, end up expanding that beyond the limits of people who can't take care of themselves to people who probably could take care of themselves but have either fallen on hard times for a short period of time or who have decided that they are going to be dependents of the state for long periods of time.
Do you ever think that we can cut back?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we are going to be able, we're going to have to. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to have a choice about it. You see austerity programs that are happening in Europe. I do think that we're going to have to restructure Social Security. It is not sustainable at the current growth rate, and it's mm-hmm. certainly not sustainable given the fact that our population is aging so rapidly and not mm-hmm. having any kids. I think that the welfare programs are going to have to be restructured. They should be restructured on the local and state level. They should not be restructured on the federal level as much. Mm-hmm. I don't see why people in California should be paying welfare for people in New York, for example. It seems to me that this is more of a local government issue more than anything else. And people want to join communities and become part of an enmeshed community when they feel like the safety net is coming from the community. I live in a very strong Orthodox Jewish community, and every Sabbath, there's an appeal for charity for family people, for families mm-hmm. who are in need. Passover is coming up. And just this past Saturday, we had an appeal in shul for people to give money for families who need money for Passover. I've done it personally for people. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, a very good thing and a much better thing than government confiscating wealth. And then that program tends to become political football pretty quickly.
Okay. So today's sponsor is Skillshare.
Absolutely.
They have lots of really cool things.
Oh, yes. An online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in design, business, technology, and more. So you want to get good at stuff? You want to make your resume better? Well, this is how you do it. You can take classes in graphic design, social media marketing, illustration, mobile photography. You name it, they've got it. So if you're just trying to deepen your professional skill set or start a side hustle or explore a new passion, Skillshare is the best thing out there to keep you learning and thriving. I've taken classes in social media marketing and watercolor because I have to calm down after the day. Join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today. We have a special offer just for my listeners. 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. So Skillshare is offering my listeners, again, 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. Once you start, you're not going to want to stop. Skillshare.com/Shapiro. That's Skillshare.com/Shapiro. And you get your 2 months for 99 cents right now. That's Skillshare.com/Shapiro.
So yay, our system is up and running. We got questions rolling in right now. Remember, everyone can watch on YouTube, Facebook, everywhere, but only subscribers can ask the questions. So be sure to go over to DailyWire.com, become a subscriber, find the conversation.
You should subscribe also to pay Alicia's salary, because let's face it, I mean, somebody's got to.
And it's only 77 cents on the dollar, so.
That's true. She's much cheaper than the alternatives, which is why she's working
here. I'm cheaper than Michael.
Don't get me started on Michael. This is not my call. This is not my call, okay?
Okay. Pablo is asking, Ben, how do you think judges should be chosen, appointed, elected, or the Missouri method?
So I think that the system that we have in which they are appointed is correct. I'm not sure they should be appointed for life. So I think that appointments with a set term as to when they expire would probably be a good thing, simply because having judges on circuit courts for 30, 40 years, I understand it was supposed to be free of political calculation. It has not been. Instead, you see judges who feel completely non-related to the politics that are going on outside and more interested in what their buddies on the bench think. Mm-hmm. And I think that you do need to do something that changes the system a little bit. Also, there's a ghoulish death watch that takes place with a lot of these courts. We're just sitting around waiting for Ginsburg to die, for example, in order to get a different justice on there. It seems to me that if you had a regular rotation, it would take a lot of the politicking out of the system. You wouldn't have as much, okay, well, who's going to die when? Who's going to stick around? It wouldn't be as much of a reality TV show. It would just be, okay, we know that every 10 years, the justice is going to drop off the bench. Mm-hmm. And so we're preparing for that battle for years in advance and staffing up for it.
And do you think that, I mean, obviously this last presidential election cycle, that seat was something that was so talked about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it became, I mean, my family members, some friends of ours.
For sure.
You know, it became a decision.
It was a big thing. I mean, Gorsuch was a big thing. And the fact is that if Justice Kennedy right now steps down, then you're looking at a possible swing vote. Although I do think that it's a mistake to think that Kennedy is the only thing standing between pro-life advocates and pro-life policy. I think that actually the swing vote there is probably going to be Roberts just as much as Kennedy. I'm not sure that Roberts votes to strike down Roe v. Wade.
Okay. Daniel says, hi, Ben. Over the last few weeks, you've expressed support for gun violence restraining order laws. While a good idea in principle, how can we ensure the system is not abused and a liberal, but like by a liberal neighbor?
Right. So I think that...
I love this question because it's a thought I've had as well.
It's very difficult. So I think that number one, you'd have to actually show that there's a close relationship between the person who is applying for the gun violence restraining order and the person who the gun is being taken away from. So it can't just be some rando on the street who decides to find that. Number two, it has to be an initial short period. So you have to show new evidence every so often. And you are going to have to rely on judges in the end to determine whether or not somebody is mentally competent. But we have that right now. I mean, there is a de facto gun violence restraining order in the form of, you know, if you're on a 24 or 48 hour hold for psychiatric reasons, this can put you on a registry. If you have been forcibly incarcerated for mental illness before, if you've been voluntarily incarcerated for mental illness, then you are put on this gun registry, essentially. So it would be an expansion of that, but obviously you want to make sure that there's some pretty good checks, and you want to make sure the burden of proof is high enough that it's not just somebody comes in, calls you crazy, and we're done.
Interesting. Joel J says, what's up, Ben? Would you consider yourself to be an audiophile? Or what gear setup do you use when consuming media, both musical and information?
So I wish that I were an audiophile. I know that Dennis Prager,
our friend, is a
huge audiophile, spends thousands of dollars on the speakers from which the music comes.
And his producer, Alan.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Well.
They're very, very into this. I don't know enough about it to actually do it. I know people who are, you know, who will only buy vinyl records, for example, because they think that the sound is better.
Hipsters.
Exactly. I've never done any of that. I listen to my music digitally, and I just discovered Apple Music, and it is the greatest thing ever.
Really?
It's so good. The access to, like, you pay a subscription fee, and then the access to thousands of albums. I mean, it's fantastic.
You love it?
Oh, it's so good.
And
I'm so
what
happy.
Were you listening to today?
Let's see. Well, today was... Brahms's German Requiem.
Uh-huh.
So some happy light music.
Yeah.
And then yesterday was I've been really on a Brahms kick lately, like a serious Brahms kick. So a lot of Brahms, the string quartets, the first string quartet's fantastic, particularly the fourth movement. The string quintet is also terrific. The piano trios, the first piano trio is just beautiful. So I need to find a cellist because my dad plays piano. I play violin. If we find a cellist, then maybe we can play some Brahms trios.
Oh, we can have some interesting lobby music happening up here at the Daily Wire.
That's what we would do, yeah. We just plant ourselves right in the lobby.
There you go. Not like you have to write on articles.
Yeah, exactly.
Bryce says, I have a friend who believes there's no place for patriotism in religion like Christianity. What are your thoughts on this? And now, how would you respond to such a statement?
So I think, first of all, most religious thinkers would obviously disagree. Augustine particularly was the first one to posit the difference between the city of God and the city of man. I mean, it says right there in the New Testament that you're supposed to, that the Caesar, you know, you follow the rule of Caesar, you follow the law of Caesar. Mm-hmm. But that's something that's existed in Judaism forever. It's a principle called dina de malchus dina, meaning that you actually have to follow the law of the land. The notion that you can't be a patriot if you are a religious believer is only true if the country is irreligious or anti-religious would be more appropriate. If the country actually seeks to crack down on your religious faith, then I guess that you would be unpatriotic to disobey the country. Mm-hmm. But okay, I mean, that's why I judge the quality of a country not based on, you know, where I was born or where the borders are. I judge the quality of a country based on the ideals the country upholds. What makes America an incredible country is the fact that we do care about religious freedom, the fact that we do not want the government intervening in people's religious lives, that we don't establish an official state religion. Right? All of these things are amazing things. And also, we don't allow the government to crack down on religious believers. Like, these are very, very important things. It's why I'm a patriot and a religious believer. But I don't think you should be a patriot if your country sucks. I think if your country is based on immoral principles or is ethnically the nation is based on ethnic solidarity alone, I think that's idiotic.
Ben wants to say, hi, Ben. Would you be open to having a live debate with Elizabeth Brunig on to iron out your differences once and for all?
I mean, I'm not sure that we would actually iron out our differences. I mean, she openly advocated for socialism.
She advocated for socialism and then just I responded, to give people some background. Yeah. You responded. Then she said, well, I was talking about Norway. And then you had a really great piece yesterday that
responding
said,
okay, on Norway. Yeah,
let's talk about Norway.
I'm perfectly happy to have a conversation with her publicly or privately. I mean, I think that it's a really interesting conversation, but she did shift her argument between article number one and article number two. Her original article suggested that socialism itself should replace capitalism. Her second article suggested that certain socialistic aspects of redistributionism should replace certain aspects of capitalism, like in the socialized medicine system. Okay, well, that's a different argument. Okay, if you're arguing that the full-scale government takeover of all industry would be a positive, then you'd have to show an example of how that's worked well for a long period of time. And using Norway as an example of that seems really weird because all they did was essentially nationalize their oil industry and then use all the wealth from that nationalized oil industry for a giant pension fund. The population of Norway is 5.6 million people, right? The population of Los Angeles County is 4 million people. So there's no people in Norway. It's not only an ethnically homogenous country. Norwegians have a special culture that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Norwegians in the United States actually earn more per capita than Norwegians who actually live in Norway. So if you're going to make the case that Norway is so great for Norwegians, well, America is better for Norwegians than Norway is for Norwegians in terms of GDP per capita. So it's an interesting argument. I think it's an argument that's worth having, and it's worth. I'd like to hear Brüning's definition of what exactly socialism constitutes because she seems to have shifted it. Originally, it was full state ownership of all resources and reuse of those resources on behalf of the workers, which sounds a lot like classical Marxism. And then it turned into, well, the state can sponsor industries in sort of mercantilist fashion and run them like capitalistic enterprises and not redistribute all income. And that's still socialism. So, you know, again, I think that it's a problem of definitions. I want to hear what her definition is or what program she's espousing. Is she suggesting that America's government nationalize the oil industry, for example? Is she suggesting that America's government impose 47.8% top tax rates? Is she suggesting that we double the price of consumer goods in the United States, which would basically bring you on par with Norway? She's not being specific. She's just saying socialism is great, and then we say it isn't. She says, well, but Norway's great, and then you say, well, there's some problems with Norway. And then she says, well, but Norway, but now you're strawmanning me, so I need to know what she's talking about.
Okay. Joel says, thoughts on the quote, fear of a name only increases fear for the thing itself, in reference to not naming mass shooters. This quote comes from Harry Potter, by the way.
Okay, so read another book. It's not the only book. Okay, so I assume that was spoken about Voldemort, right? He who shall not be named. Okay, fine. So I generally agree with the sentiment that you should name people who are bad, but that does not apply to people who are driven by
fame.
Publicity to go and shoot people, right? When you say radical Islamic terror, I'm not sure that actually creates more radical Islamic terror. But if you were to give glory to the person who was the radical Islamic terrorist, that may create more incentive to be a radical Islamic terror. I think that naming villains generally is I think, a problem because there are a lot of people who find solace in that and they find honor in that and they think that that's a good excuse to go killing people.
Which is something that
that's why over the Daily Wire we don't print the names or the pictures of mass shooters specifically because there's some studies that suggest that would actually to name them and show their pictures would heighten the possibility of mass shooters.
Daryl says hello from Ireland.
Wow, hello.
He also says you're awful for not wearing green.
Donald.
No, I'm kidding. I added that part.
I figured.
He says, Ben, what is your opinion on Andrew Tate's proposition that depression is just a safety crutch and an excuse when people fail at life?
I think that's largely a bunch of crap. I think depression is a chemical imbalance. I know people who have been depressed. I know people for whom antidepressants have been highly useful. Listen, do I think that it is possible to intervene with people who are suffering from depression sometimes and then use the and use, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy to get them out of that spin, out of that funk? I think that's possible. I think that the rise in depression rates in the United States is an indicia of the is an indicator of the loss of purpose broadly across American society that's happening. I'm writing a book on that right now. But does depression exist as a clinical condition? Absolutely, it exists as a clinical condition. And I don't think that and I don't think that it's fair to folks to suggest that, you know, just toughen up and get over it. I think there are a lot of people who actually do need some chemical help.
Amy says, hi, Ben, I'll be graduating soon, and we have a tradition of decorating our caps with quotes or images. Any recommendations?
Well, it depends where you're graduating from, right? If you're graduating in, like, a gender studies program, then I would just put need a job and your phone number on the top of the hat, because that's absolutely true. You will need a job. And so I would start there.
Okay.
Also, I mean, you can quote me. I mean, not to be self-aggrandizing, but, I mean, sure, why not? Since you suggest it. Absolutely. Let's see. What else? There are a bunch of good Winston Churchill quotes. I think the problem is most of these quotes are too long, right? If you quote John Adams, the Constitution was made for only a moral and religious people. It is insufficient to the cause of any other. I really think that's going to be a little long for the hat.
Any Maggie Thatcher quotes or something she could throw on there?
I think it's a Maggie Thatcher quote. Well, I mean, the famous Maggie Thatcher quote is, of course, I think a paraphrase from Orwell, that that he who robs Peter to pay Paul can always count on the vote of can always count on Paul's vote. Mm-hmm. So that's always a good one. But
if you want to go into politics, it might not work.
Yeah, exactly.
As well. This is a really fun question. Maggie says, "Hi Ben, if you're stranded on an island with somehow only enough technology to watch one movie over and over until you died, escaped, or were rescued, which movie would you choose?"
Ooh,
that's unique too. Good for her.
Yeah, that'd have to be a really long movie, right? I mean,
get to watch it over and over and over again.
That's true.
It could be a three-part question. Like, if you died, how long, or rescued? Right?
Oh yeah. I mean, so that's true. I would say if you only have one movie and you're going to be there forever, then you almost have to pick Kenneth Branagh's production of Hamlet. It's 4 hours long and it's Hamlet, right? That'll at least give you some analysis. Uh-huh. But if you're talking about, like, what's the movie that I think is most meaningful and most well done, I think there's good arguments made for The Lives of Others. This is William F. Buckley's favorite movie.
Okay.
This is a foreign feature that came out in, I think, 2005, won Best Foreign Film 2006. It's a fantastic movie about the East German Stasi spying on this artist in East Germany who they think has become a dissenter, even though he really hasn't, and how the Stasi spy is actually changed by watching people interact. It's a fascinating movie. Check it out. The Lives of Others. It's a very anti-communist film.
Never seen it. So we are very grateful for our sponsors over at Skillshare.
Of course. So Skillshare, as we told you, is an online learning platform. Over 18,000 classes in design, business, technology, and more. You can take classes in graphic design, social media marketing, illustration, mobile photography. I've taken some in social media marketing. I've taken some in watercolor. So whether you're trying to deepen your professional skill set or start a side hustle or just explore a new passion, Skillshare makes sure that you're learning. Listen, if you lose your job, you want to make sure that your resume is constantly growing. If you don't lose your job, make sure that your resume is constantly growing. Increase your level of pay. Okay, this is what Skillshare is for. And there are millions of students already learning on Skillshare today. They have a special offer for my listeners. 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents, which is 44.5 cents on average. That's right. Skillshare is offering my listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Shapiro. That's Skillshare.com/Shapiro. Get those 2 months right now. Skillshare.com/Shapiro. Check it out.
So everyone is watching the latest episode of The Conversation. I'm Alicia Krauss. And of course, we have our very own editor-in-chief of The Daily Wire, Ben Shapiro, of The Ben Shapiro Show. Subscribers can ask their questions live over at dailywire.com, and Ben will answer them for everyone to hear. We are rolling through them as fast as they're coming in. So we're trying, folks. To ask questions as a subscriber, be sure to log on to our website, dailywire.com, to watch the live stream and head over to the conversation page. After that, you must start typing into the Daily Wire chat box, where we will pull live questions as they are posted. So you can go to subscribe to the Daily Wire right now to ask your questions and join our conversation. Next episode is going to feature Andrew Klavan. I'll be talking to him on Tuesday, April 10th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 3:30 Pacific. That's people are watching on YouTube and on Facebook and at the Daily Wire website.
And as
we
say,
right,
please
now
subscribe. It really does help us with our business and make sure that Alicia can have beautiful St. Patrick's Day attire. It's very important.
Very important. I'll be doing a little Celtic dance after this.
So, no, you won't.
So Mathis said that this reminded him of a Lord of the Rings dress, and I was like, that's the best compliment ever.
That is a very good compliment. It reminds me of a carpet.
Oh. If it's Persian, that means it's really expensive and nice.
But it isn't.
It's cozy.
So, want to go on with the questions, or should I continue with the insult comedy?
No, let's move on. Noah says, hey, Ben, I recently read a great case for abolishing the U.S. Postal Service. Well,
yes,
mean, that's any case,
that's
right?
That's any case. No.
Which federal agencies and departments are you in favor of abolishing?
All of them. No, so I would keep the Department of War, and I would rename it the Department of War. Not enough of this Department of Defense nonsense. Department of War. That's what it was originally called, because it's there to make war. Okay, so I would keep the Department of War. Mm-hmm. I would keep the Department of State. I would get rid of the Department of Education. I'd get rid of the Department of Energy. I'd get rid of the third one that Rick Perry doesn't know. And I'd get rid of the Department of Health and Human Services. I would get rid of the EPA is a cabinet level position. There are a bunch of them that I think are
just
worth getting.
The
Postal Service, pretty much. Like, it would go back to its original functions, and everything else would be devolved back to the state or local level.
Okay.
It seems to me the best way to do this, because
especially education.
Education department is so awful.
Yeah.
It's a department of housing and urban development.
Why is the federal government? Ben Carson would be out of a job, and then he can't buy a $30,000 table.
He does like expensive. He's an expensive cabinet in an expensive cabinet. It's true.
Within. But I think Scott Pruitt over at EPA is trying really hard.
He is. I think Scott Pruitt has been doing a fine job.
Pretty good job.
Listen, I think that Trump's cabinet overall has been doing a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm glad Rex Tillerson is gone, as I said earlier. I mm-hmm. think that Mattis has been very good at defense. There are a bunch of people who are very good in the Trump administration.
Eric has a very serious question that probably a lot of people don't have the answer to. Is your wife a doctor?
So the rumor is that she is. In the last 10 years of my life that I've spent watching her go through medical school and then residency all the time, suggests that she is. You wonder why I'm so proud that my wife is a doctor? Number one, I'm proud of her because she's a special person and because that takes a lot of work. But second of all, it's my accomplishment too, okay? I was here for the whole thing. It's been so long and so terrible. But she's actually a fantastic doctor. It's obviously her accomplishment. Fine, okay.
You had to help pay for it.
I did pay for it, that's true.
You have to take the kid to violin. I'm
very proud of her, and she should be able to. This is actually an important thing, I think, about relationships. Mm-hmm. Very early on when we got married, my wife was at UCLA, mm-hmm. and I got a job offer in New York. And I thought seriously about taking the job offer in New York. And she was ready to transfer from UCLA, a better school, to Rutgers, which is not as highly ranked a school, mm-hmm. in New York, in order so that we could pursue that job opportunity. I remember when she got into med school, at the beginning, we only thought that she had gotten into Georgetown, mm-hmm. And not into UCLA. She ended up getting to UCLA. And when she thought she was going to have to go to Georgetown, we seriously considered moving coast. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, well, then I'll pick up and we'll move. It is very important that people in relationships know that they are willing to go the full mile for the other person in the relationship. My wife knows that that is true for me, and I know that that's true for her as well.
A good relationship advice from our very own Ben Shapiro.
Indeed.
Also, marry a hot doctor, folks. Christy wants to know, do you believe that the miracles of the Bible, such as in the Exodus and the wilderness wandering, are literally true, as I do, or just symbolic? Also, what version of the Bible are you reading from?
So the version of the Bible that I read from is called the Bible. It's in Hebrew. and I read
the original.
The original.
The OG.
The OG of Bibles. Yeah, that's right. The translation that I typically use, if I'm using a translation, is the Art Scroll, which is very typically used in the Orthodox Jewish community. The King James is good. I mean, mm-hmm. I think there's some problems with some of the King James translations as far as the Hebrew of it. But, as far as the New Testament translations, I will vary between various translations. Okay, but mm-hmm. As far as which miracles to take literally, so my tendency is to take the miracles in Exodus as literally as possible, and to take the miracles before that as metaphorical, because mm-hmm. it is unclear when in the Bible the characters start becoming literal. My guess is probably with Abraham, but if you look at Adam and Eve, it's pretty clear that this is metaphorical. And also, once you get to the Exodus, I tend to be more along the lines of Maimonides, who suggested that that the miracles can largely be explained alternatively as kind of physical occurrences that could occur in the real world through natural processes, but that were miraculous nonetheless. So, for example, it says directly in Exodus that when the sea is split, that there's a strong wind that comes and blows over the mouth of the water, and that's what creates the split in the sea. Mm-hmm. So why does it bother actually describing that? Why didn't you just say God split the sea, boom, we're done? Mm-hmm. Because the idea here is that God uses natural means as often as possible in order to push miracles, because God actually doesn't want to show his hand all that often. Instead, he wants you to have to discover the miracle that is inherent in life.
Okay. Interesting. Adam says, hey, Ben, a huge fan. Would you vote for Donald Trump if the election was held today?
So you know, my calculation would be a lot harder, actually, than it was last time. So I had three worries when Donald Trump was elected. One is that he would not govern as conservative. Two is that he would soul suck the Republican Party. And three was that he would be so toxic that he would end up destroying any hope of popularity for conservative principles I care about. So on the first one, did he govern as somebody on the left? The answer is no. So far, he has governed very strongly as somebody on the right. We'll see if that maintains or not. Obviously, I hope it would. Based on his policy, I'd vote for him. As far as the damage that he, the possibility of him soul sucking the Republican Party and transforming it from a conservative party to a nationalist populist party, I'm a lot less worried about that than I was a year ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the constituency inside the cabinet has changed. Steve Bannon is no longer there. There's no longer such an attempt to shift away from traditional conservatism. So that, I think, was exaggerated, and I'm very happy about that. I think that people in the conservative movement see Trump as a vehicle more than they see him as a leader on thought. Mm-hmm. And then there is the final one, which is, does Trump toxify the conservative movement such that it would be impossible to vote for him? And there, the jury is really still out. He's done a lot of things that are very toxic for conservatives. I don't just mean Stormy Daniels or the stuff that he said about Charlottesville. I do mean, I also mean that the president routinely speaks in ways that I think are inappropriate for the president to speak, and also says stuff that's just counterproductive to the agenda that I care about. He doesn't defend it well. He says silly things on a routine basis. And there are a lot of young people who are looking at Trump and saying, I'm never going to vote conservative if this is what conservatives are. So on that one, the jury is still out. I think most of the damage on that score has been done because Trump's already been in office. So my tendency would probably be to vote for him for re-election if it were held today. But again, the election isn't today, so we'll see where we are in 3 years.
And 2018, how do you think Republicans are going to do?
I mean, right now, the statistics are not good. If you look at the, you know, the PA-18 results should be coming in pretty soon here. But if you look at, how Republicans have been doing in the special elections. There have been 7 special elections since January 1, 2017. And on average, Republicans have underperformed by 16 points, their 2016 numbers. So that's a pretty major gap. In some places, obviously, like Alabama, you're talking about like a 30-point swing, which is pretty incredible.
Mike says, I am reading P. Johnson's History of Christianity and was wondering what your view is on the Christian sect's break from the various Jewish sects of the time, and what does current Judaism say on this?
Okay, so Christianity, so the history of Christianity is really interesting because obviously there was Pauline Christianity and Jamesian Christianity, and these were not exactly the same. There's good read that, historically speaking, when upon Jesus's death, and as Christians believe resurrection, but as Jews believe just death, right? That upon his death, that there were two things that there were two schools of thought. One was that he'd been resurrected, and the other was that he had not been resurrected, but he was a political messianic figure who had important things to say, right? Mm-hmm. So it was sort of like the Christianity was more originally like how the Lubavitcher Jews view the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that he was an important leader who had important things to say, and so we follow his legacy, but not that he was God incarnate or anything like that. You know, the early Judaism would suggest that, you know, if Jesus was just seen as sort of a rebellious figure who was trying to say correct things about Judaism as far as it becoming too legalistic and there needs to be more focus on your relationship with God and all of that, that's not out of line with any of the prophets beforehand. If you are a believer in Jesus, as is currently believed by Christians, that he's the physical incarnation of God, come to earth and then resurrected and all of this, then that is completely foreign to Jewish thought, which is why I'm not a Christian, right? If we're just Jesus was a good rabbi, then I think a lot of the stuff that he says is basically a repeat of stuff from the Old Testament, and some of the best stuff he says is fantastic. If it's Jesus is the Son of God, then Jews don't believe Jesus was the Son of God because on a fundamental level, we don't believe that God takes physical form. We believe that God is incorporeal.
Okay. Good. I hope that answered her question.
I hope
pretty,
so, too.
But pretty detailed. Yeah. Johnny says, hey, Ben, if you could choose between Plato or Machiavelli, who would you choose in advising President Trump?
Ooh, this is such a good question. Okay, so there's a good question for two reasons. So first, let's define Plato and Machiavelli. So Machiavelli, for those
in
who don't know.
Terms.
Right. So Plato, for those who don't know, is you know, kind of the godfather of all philosophy. And Plato's essential contention was that human beings were stuck in a cave and they didn't have access to a wider array of knowledge, but that you could go outside the cave and you could bring back knowledge to the people who are still in the cave. He was trying to access higher forms of logic, essentially. There's something that he called the realm of ideas, the realm of forms, and the realm of forms was the place where, I don't want to get too abstruse here, because I'm literally writing an entire book on this right now, so I could really go on it.
I can't wait to read it, by the way.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. But the basic idea in Plato is that there are certain Platonic forms, right? When people say it's a Platonic idea of something, what they mean is the ultimate form of that thing. So Plato would say that the reason that you can identify various types of dogs in your everyday life is because there's such a thing in the realm of ideas, in the realm of forms, as the form of dog, right? The ideal Platonic dog. And so he feels the same way about certain concepts like justice. So all of Plato's Republic is an attempt to define what virtue and justice look like. And for him to define that through argumentation and reason in the voice of Socrates arguing with his various students. So on the one hand, I would like to have President Trump think a little bit more about Platonic ideals of justice and courage and all of the things that Plato talks about. On the other hand, if you read Plato's Republic, Plato's Republic suggests that in order for us to actually achieve a societal form of virtue or justice, then you might actually have to have a top-down tyranny in which children are taken away from their parents and re-inculcated in the lessons of civics by the society itself. There are a lot of people like Leo Strauss who think that that's actually Plato making fun of the idea of utopia. That's possible, but I'm afraid that Trump might misread it, so I don't think that would probably be good. Machiavelli, of course, was the first practical philosopher. Instead of trying to think how men can be, what we should expect from men, how men better themselves, Machiavelli says, here's how people are, and here's how you control people how they are. So Machiavelli's idea of virtu versus the Platonic idea of virtue is very different. So virtue is the idea that you are supposed to use your higher faculties of reason in order to come to these Platonic ideas of justice and courage and virtue and all the rest of this. That's what virtue is. You're supposed to use your highest level of reason because man was created in order to reason. This is what man is. Mankind was developed in order to use his higher functions. This is why philosophy is the highest form of life, according to Plato. According to Machiavelli, human beings are just human beings, right? We're a bunch of schmucks, and we walk around being schmucky, and that's pretty much all we do all day. And so what the good leader will do is he will use virtue. Virtue is essentially using good methods and bad methods in order to achieve your political goal from time to time. So he's the first kind of practical politician, is Machiavelli. And many people think that he's sort of the founder of modern political philosophy because most political philosophy from then on is based on, okay, people suck, what do we do about it? As opposed to philosophy before that, which is people suck, how do we make people better? Machiavelli and many other philosophers at the time turned to, okay, people suck, but they have to be balanced out with other people through checks and balances and all the rest of this. So I think that from the perspective of limited government, Machiavelli he should read, and from the perspective of virtue, he should read Plato. How's that?
Okay, but advising him?
I mean, I think that as a political advisor, Machiavelli would be a better political advisor than Plato because he's just a great political advisor. As far as somebody advising him on virtue, I'd recommend Plato.
Okay. Bob says, is there a problem with people consensually signing contracts that restrict their liberties? How about agreeing to be subject to a government that may force me to do things as I'm better off overall?
Okay, so you can sign away certain liberties. The idea of inalienable rights is just the idea that we don't want you to be able to sign away your liberties, but we sign away our liberties every day, right? I mean, we sign contracts where we trade our labor in exchange for something else. Mm-hmm. The question is, was there ever a social contract in which you traded away certain liberties to the government? So did you trade away your right to life to the government? So Hobbes would actually say yes. Hobbes would say you traded away your right to life because you're asking that the government protect you, but you have to give away all your rights that the government can do all that. The government's now in control. But Locke would say you didn't give away your rights. What you did is you said to the government, it's your job to preserve those rights. The only thing I'm signing away to you is my ability to protect myself. But if you don't protect me, then you violated your job as the government. So if we're talking about inalienable rights, then I don't think that from a natural rights perspective, you could sign away your right to self-defense, for example. I think that that's impossible to sign away. Practically speaking, you can sign away anything, right? But from a moral standpoint, I think that anybody who would allow you to sign away your right to self-defense is doing you a deep disservice, obviously.
Okay. Yakov, I hope I'm saying that right. Do you think I'm saying
that Yakov right? Yeah, Yakov is probably right.
Ben and I were joking earlier. I always biff something, usually a name, during these conversations, but only with him. With Andrew and Michael, I always seem to come off smarter. I don't know why. He says, hi, Ben. If you know someone that is running for senator, would you vote for them if they are a Democrat?
So if I found out that Michael Knowles is a Cubs fan, would I fire him? If I found out that Michael Knowles is here, I'd fire him. I mean, that's what kind of question is that?
That was the PS, though, the first question.
That was
question.
The PS. That's the only one I'm interested in, though. That's like a red flag in front of a bull. If I found out that somebody who I knew was running for senator and they were a Democrat, would I vote for them? I don't know. Do I agree with them? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think the party label matters nearly as much as the ideas they represent. I think it's very hard for somebody with good ideas to caucus with the Democrats these days.
Interesting. Addison says, hey, Ben, I was having a discussion with some friends the other day after reading Matt Walsh's article on pornography. I think it should be banned. What are your thoughts on this?
So this is a really interesting one. So I wrote an entire book called Porn Generation when I was 21, in which I talked about the possibility of local regulation with regard to pornography. Mm-hmm. And obviously, there are certain areas of pornography where we do regulate. So we don't allow pornographic billboards because that is something that's happening in the public space. That's a space we all share. Mm-hmm. But the idea of regulating pornography on, for example, the internet is much tougher because that's something that you actively have to seek out. So I have become more libertarian on this issue in one sense. I think pornography is deeply damaging to the human psyche. I think it's deeply damaging to men. I think it creates unrealistic expectations of what women are and mostly what women want, more than how women look. Everybody looks at pornography, oh, you expect women to look that way. It's not about that. It's about that men expect women to act that way. Men expect that women are constantly sexually voracious the way that men are. They are not. Spoiler alert, guys. But the pornographic ideal has led to a lot of suffering, because then there are a lot of women who think that in order for them to be loved by a man, they have to act the way that men are expecting them to act via pornography. Mm-hmm. So that's all. And there's some pretty good evidence that pornography hits the same pleasure centers in your brain as drugs do, and that pornography is addictive. I think that that's probably true, that pornography is addictive. So should there be regulation of it? I don't think on a federal level there should. I think that if you want to set up a local community where you say we're not going to allow public distribution of pornography in our local community, that is perfectly within your right. This is why I like localism in government. And if you don't want to live in that neighborhood, don't live in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I think that's perfectly fine. But I think there's a difference in local regulation and non-local regulation. From a libertarian perspective, I would suggest that the better solution than that is to just, you know, work on a community that is virtuous, because regulation is usually used as a way to stave off the failure of your community, and it rarely works that way. Usually, a strong community doesn't need regulation, and a weak community cannot be saved by regulation.
Okay. Hewan says, what are some examples of government tyranny that would warrant the civilian use of firearms in order to retaliate?
Okay, complete gun seizure. So if the federal government said we are taking every gun in private hands away from the citizens of the United States, that would warrant the use of firearms against members of the federal government, for example. I think that I'm not talking about like they decide to take one class of gun. I'm talking about they take every gun in the United States. Mm-hmm. If they decided that they were going to install a state religion that violated my rights across the United States to practice my religion, then the founders certainly would have thought of that as a violation. If they were to violate the right to free speech to suggest that I'm not allowed to speak as I see fit, then that would warrant this. So, you know, there are gradations to this, obviously, mm-hmm. because there's also the question of not what would warrant it, but what's the best way of fighting bad stuff. So let's say that the government were to, like, for example, there are a lot of people who say, well, the government mandates that states allow abortion. Abortion is murder. So therefore, why shouldn't you stand up to the states? Why shouldn't you stand up to the federal government? And the answer is because it would be utterly counterproductive. So the question there isn't really a moral one so much as it is a practical one. There is no way that you could that you're going to win hearts and minds or prevent abortion by bombing abortion clinics, for example. So this is, you know, I think that there's an element of practicality to this question, and there's an element of morality to this question. The moral argument that is, until the government goes to the full extreme, force is not to be used, and until the government uses force on you, force is not to be used. And then beyond that, is it practical to use force, or better to use the methods of a republic, which is why the founders set up a republic, so we could change policy from the inside rather than resorting to bloodshed.
What about the people that say, oh, we're in the year 2018, do you guys really need to fight the government in that way?
I mean, the answer is it depends what the government does. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's tyranny happening all over the world right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the government of Syria is murdering its own citizens. I would prefer that those citizens have firearms to protect themselves.
Evan says, hi, Ben, what are your thoughts on Benjamin Netanyahu? Is he good or bad for Israel?
He's been quite a good prime minister. I mean, first of all, Israel is a very unstable political system, meaning it's a coalition government system. You have to have a majority in Knesset in order to govern. That means that you always have to form coalitions with other parties, and all of these little parties have various giveaways that they want. And if there's a vote of no confidence, or if new elections are called, you have to have a new election. So Netanyahu has been serving continuously as prime minister of Israel for, I believe, 11 years now, which is a really, really long mm-hmm. time. In Israeli politics, basically, it's a four-year term for the prime minister, but I think only one prime minister has served a full four-year term, so it's very rare to actually live that out.
Okay.
He's done a very good job on foreign policy with regard to Iran. I do wonder if Israel is going to hit Iran, if nobody else is going to, if Iran continues to develop nuclear weapons. They've been boxed in by the Iran deal that Obama signed. As far as domestic policy, I think in some ways Netanyahu has been even better, actually. I think Netanyahu has been very good on economics, and also Netanyahu has worked pretty hard and staunchly to try and bridge gaps between the religious, the dati, this means literally people who know, right? Dati is religious people in Israel, and the secular, and the Tzioni, the Zionists, the secular groups in Israel. He's tried to bridge those gaps by trying to get religious people to serve in the army, which I think is actually a wonderful thing.
Ethan says, the introduction of judicial review from Marbury versus Madison conferred dangerous powers to the judicial branch. But if not that branch, who would ask the constitutional question to other branches?
So the answer is that everybody would ask the constitutional question to each other. So everyone takes an oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States. One of the dumbest things I've seen in politics is George W. Bush, who I really respect as a human being. But George W. Bush, when he signed into law campaign finance reform in 2003, mm-hmm. he said, I think this is unconstitutional, but it's not my job to to veto legislation I think is unconstitutional, it's up to the Supreme Court to decide whether it's constitutional or not. And the answer to that is no. You swore an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is that if everyone was going to uphold their oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, that they wouldn't kick the can all the way over to the Supreme Court.
Every single time.
That's right. And the Supreme Court, it should not be the final arbiter of what's constitutional or not. That should be up to the legislature. It should be up to the president. It should be part of the interplay. Every time we pass a bill, we should have a large-scale discussion as to whether that bill is constitutional or not, and people who do not abide by the constitutional strictures should be in danger of losing their jobs. That was the original concept. Mm-hmm. Being able to abdicate that responsibility to the judicial branch has allowed politicians to get away with passing stuff that is wildly unconstitutional.
Abraham asks, what do you think of Gerald Schroeder's using Einstein's theory of relativity and time dilation as a way reconciling the biblical 6 days of creation with a 13.8 billion years accepted by science?
So I think it's great. Gerald Schroeder's book is fantastic. It's called, I believe, Science of the Big Bang, God in the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. I've recommended it on the show, actually. It's a thing that I like. So his basic theory is that when it says in the Bible one day, it doesn't mean literally one day because the sun hasn't been created on the first day. It says the first day, but there's no sun. So what does it mean, a day? So what he does is he takes the background radiation levels in the universe and he says, over the course of a 24-hour period, there would be this many wavelengths in a 24-hour period at the beginning of the universe. And so as the universe expands, then time expands as well. So the number of wavelengths in a day decreases radically over time, which means that if you were to take the number of wavelengths in the first day, and you were to expand that number of wavelengths and call that a day, then you'd be looking at 13.8 billion years. I think I'm basically getting that right.
Fascinating. How do you explain that to a four-year-old, though?
I mean, I don't. That one I'll save for later.
I'm asking because I'm like the non-denominational Bible Belt person. That
right.
In Sunday school, you learn that God created the earth
in seven days. Right. So for now, you teach that, and then if they ask, well, my science teacher says it's 13.8 billion years. Then you say that's because the Bible is speaking in language that human beings can understand, but the real answer is 13.8 billion years, because I think that science and God are, science is God's creation, in my viewpoint. And so if science comes into conflict with God, it's because we're misunderstanding God or we're misunderstanding science, not because science has taken precedent over God.
Okay. Devin says, I have friends that like you, but they say that you criticize the president too much. What can I do or say to convince them that it is important to stand up against Trump when he does something bad for us?
Well, I mean, again, I think that what's going to make Trump a better president is people who say to him, you're not allowed to do this. Now, you've seen this throughout his first term, that he's corrected mistakes. I mean, when he's done stuff that's wrong and people shout about it, then he corrects it. This happened in the last week and a half. The president did a full-on press conference in which he suggested that we should not use due process for people who are mentally ill before taking away their guns. And people on the right said, that's crazy, you can't do that. And then he backed off of that. I think his tariff plan, which originally did not include exclusions for Canada and Mexico, he's backed off of that, and we still don't know how exactly it's going to be implemented. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you want a better president, you owe yourself the same level of criticism of the president, whether that president is a Democrat or Republican. Now, you may think Trump's doing a better job than Obama. I think Trump's doing a better job than Obama on policy. I do. But does that mean that I won't criticize him when he does something wrong? No, because that's a question about me, right? What am I supposed to do? It's not a question about Trump. Right? The question is whether I'm going to tolerate things I think are wrong just because I have loyalty to a guy or because I'm rooting for that guy harder than I'm rooting for the other guy, or whether I'm going to say, listen, when he does something wrong, it's a wrong thing, regardless of whether I like the guy. I think, by the way, it's a very bad parenting strategy to let your kid slide on stuff you wouldn't let another kid slide on. In the same way, I think that's true of presidents.
That's a good point, the kid analogy.
Oh, thank you.
Don't let other, you want somebody else's kid to be a punk,
yeah,
so don't let your kid be
right,
a punk.
Right, if you see another kid at the mall and the kid's being a brat, and you say, God, that kid's being a brat, and then your kid does the exact same thing 5 seconds later, like, oh, but I love my kid. Right, but now you're making your kid a brat. Like,
yep.
That's the problem.
Robert says, hi, Ben. How do you find the best books to read on any given subject?
So, I mean, what I typically tend to do is I try to find the longest, most comprehensive one. For example, when I want to learn Iranian history, I will check out three or four different... I shop for books the same way most people do. I go on Amazon and I check out three or four different books that are sort of the history of Iran, and then I see which people have endorsed, because you can sort of tell which way a book leans by the endorsers on a book. So if you have a book that's endorsed by The Nation, and then you have another book that's endorsed by The Wall Street Journal, I'm more likely to pick up the one endorsed by The Wall Street Journal, because I think The Wall Street Journal has a more reality-based view of things than The Nation does. But if I have time, I'll try to read both of them, obviously.
Okay, interesting. James says, hey, Ben, would you rather have the state looking after children without a home or a same-sex couple?
So if that is the choice, if it's like living in an orphanage, not in a foster home or anything, if it's like living in an old school orphanage and with crappy living conditions, of course a same-sex couple. I mean, that's yes, but that's not that is not the optimal situation. So the way that the law was designed to work is to promote the optimal situation. By the way, there are millions of straight couples, men, women couples, who are who are seeking children right now, and the adoption system is just awful. The adoption system takes tons of time, it takes tons of money, it takes tons of effort. It is very difficult to adopt a child in the United States. I know, I have lots of friends who have adopted kids, I have lots of I have family members who have adopted children. It is not an easy thing to do. But obviously there are gradations of suffering of children, and if you were to say, like, who's to suffer more, a child in an orphanage in China who never sees an adult, or the kid in the same-sex family in West Hollywood, obviously the kid in China. But that doesn't mean that on average level, I think same-sex couples bring up children in the same way that opposite-sex couples do. They don't. I don't think men and women are the same. I don't think they bring up children the same. I think they bring different qualities to bear in raising of children. I think that's a good thing.
Okay. We have more questions pouring in. You are watching this special edition of The Conversation. It's we have Ben Shapiro here. And don't forget to tune in again in April. On April 10th, I'll be talking to Andrew Klavan. So that'll be lots of fun. That will be at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, right here at dailywire.com. Blake says, Ben, I have a friend who claims that communism is the inevitable result of capitalism. He usually cites...
Slavoj Žižek.
That's how it's
pronounced. Yeah.
There we go.
I don't know his work all that well, so I'm not going to specifically countenance work that I don't know. I'd like to read it before I result. I do not think that communism is the inevitable result of capitalism, but I do think that capitalism is not self-fulfilling. One of the things that's really interesting right now, I'm reading Jonah Goldberg's book, the draft of his new book. And it is quite good. I've also read Steven Pinker's book on the Enlightenment. And I think one of the things that's happening among people who are very fond of the Enlightenment, I'm very fond of the Enlightenment too. If you like America, if you like Western liberalism, you're fond of the Enlightenment.
Yep.
But one of the things that I think has happened is that people think that the Enlightenment is self-defending, that it's self-evident, and it isn't. And I think that one of the things that capitalism does not provide is meaning. Capitalism provides wealth. Capitalism provides prosperity. Capitalism provides freedom. Capitalism does not provide purpose. It does not provide meaning. And when it comes time for people to pick up a gun and fight, then I think the observation that was originally made during the Spanish Civil War holds true. And that observation, which is quoted in Daniel Yergin and Joseph Stanislaus' The Commanding Heights, is that the Spanish Civil War is fought between the fascists and the communists. And somebody once said about the communists that they died with Stalin on their lips. And Stanislaw and Yergin say, well, nobody ever died with free markets on their lips, which is true, right? Nobody ever says, I'm dying today for capitalism. I'm dying today for laissez-faire economics and freedom of goods to move across borders without tariffs, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody ever says that because that's not stuff that provides purpose and meaning. It's just something that we enjoy. And it doesn't even register, as Goldberg says, I think it doesn't register with us on a fairness level, even though it is the most fair system of distribution of wealth to own your own labor. That means that there has to be something else that provides the purpose. So if the idea is that people are going to supplant capitalism with things they find more purposeful by manipulating other people, I think that there's probably some truth to that. I don't know if that's Žižek's argument, but I think that argument is true, which is why you need a virtuous citizenry in order to have a free citizenry. Okay, a citizenry that is not virtuous and doesn't care about virtue and doesn't care about community and doesn't take care of each other on a non-governmental level will inevitably slide toward a bigger government community that sees purpose in confiscating the wealth of others.
Marcus says, hey, Ben, given the statistics show that millennials favor gun rights, are Democrats shooting themselves in the foot by pushing legislation that essentially denies them the ability to own guns?
Well, I mean, I think Democrats are always shooting themselves in the foot on the gun issue. I think they mistake a couple of polls. So I've said this many times on the show. When there's a poll that shows that a vast majority of Americans support more gun control, that's about the same as saying the vast majority of Americans support cuts to government. It means nothing. The question is, do they support this cut to government? Do they support this gun control method? So I think that Democrats mistake that as, well, that means that we should just shout about taking away guns. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. When people hear gun control, what they hear is something that would stop the guy from shooting up the school. Mm-hmm. We all like that. Sounds great. But when you say, that also means you're going to have to give up your shotgun that you use for home defense, everybody goes, nope, not interested.
Nape wants to know, do you think the Japanese method of background checks for gun purchases is the best method in the United States?
So again, I'll plead ignorance on this. I'm not familiar with the Japanese method of background checks. I know that they have extraordinarily heavy gun control in Japan. Their suicide rate, by the way, remains about the same as the United States, I believe. Oh. I believe, but I want to check that.
Okay. Interesting. We could Google it maybe real quick while we wait for another question to come in. I don't know.
I can write an article or something. it sounds good. Like nothing happened.
I'll put my phone on airplane mode.
Guys, questions.
Never
come on.
Mind. Never
or
mind.
Subscribe we'll go right to... now. Subscribe. Go.
Right now.
Ask questions. More.
Hurry up. Go.
Okay.
All right. Here's an interesting one we have from the mailbag. Hannah Mallory says, Dear Ben, I think I remember an episode where you said that Orthodox Jews believe they and Christians will be in heaven together. I'm wondering if that is the case, why anyone would bother going through the trouble of being Orthodox at all. I mean, because us Christians get to eat bacon.
Yeah.
I added that, not Hannah. So she says, as a Protestant, I appreciate your perspective and always enjoy learning about your faith.
So this is where the question of obligation comes in. So ethnic Judaism and religious Judaism have crossover, meaning that you're not obligated in Jewish ritual law unless you are born Jewish. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not big on converts. We'll take them if people want to mm-hmm. convert. But our general rule is that if you're not born into Judaism, then you are not actually obligated in Judaism. So the idea here is that if a Jew converts out of Judaism, then you have not fulfilled your basic obligation under Judaism. So a Jewish convert to Christianity like Andrew Klavan, I don't know what would happen to Drew, you know, under the heavenly system. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I really know a lot about what happens after we die, because I'm not sure a lot of people know about what happens after we die. Mm-hmm. But by Orthodox Jewish lights, Andrew would be in trouble, Michael Mull would be fine. Right, that's because if you were born ethnically Jewish, then you have certain obligations. You remain a Jew. In other words, in Judaism, you can't convert out of being Jewish. You are still Jewish even if you convert to Christianity. Mm-hmm. You're just a person who's not practicing Judaism. You're practicing Christianity. So that's the Jewish religious perspective.
Paul has a question about classical music. He says, "Hi Ben, I know you like classical music, so I was wondering if you have heard any music from the Legend of Zelda games. These games introduced me to classical music."
I have heard a little bit of it, and I think it's pretty good.
Really?
I'm shocked by the quality of some of the video game music. I mean, yeah. Some of the Halo music is fantastic. There's a bunch of really good video game music that I'm kind of impressed by. On Pandora, I have like the movie channel. Uh-huh. Channel, the movie music channel.
Yeah,
exactly. And very often they'll bring up some music. I'll be like, that's pretty good. And then I'll look and I'm like, this is from a video game. That's pretty amazing.
That's fascinating. Will says, "Hey, Ben, I just finished the Last Lion trilogy you recommended."
Good for you, Will. It's long.
"I am wondering what your thoughts are on a parliamentary system versus our system of government here in the United States. Love the show."
Okay, so I'm not really a big fan of the parliamentary system because it creates such instability in government. So parliamentary system, as I mentioned a little bit earlier with regard to Israel, which has a parliamentary system, is a system, there are a couple different ways to do it, but a typical parliamentary system, to give one example, would be the list system. So this is the kind of system they have in Britain. So you have a bunch of parties that exist in separate districts. Mm-hmm. And, there's the House of Lords and the House of Commons. But in any case, Israel has a list system. Britain has a district system. Israel's system, I'll use Israel's, is a list system. So you vote for the Labor Party. Labor puts forward a list of the various members of their party they want to get in. And if they win 28% of the vote, then they get 28% of the seats. And everybody who is on that list all the way down to the 28th percent gets in. Mm. The problem with this is that you have a bunch of splinter parties. So that means that you have to form coalitions with parties in order to get over that majority voting block. And that means that you're constantly cutting deals with people. I think the inevitable growth of government is the result. It's very difficult to actually cut government in a system where you have things like the Pensioners Party that win seats in Israel, right? Mm. Which is literally just a bunch of old people who wanted higher pensions. And they formed their own party and they won just enough seats to be a swing voting contingent in Israel. In the parliamentary system in Britain is somewhat similar. There's more instability. It's not nearly as unstable as Israel's system because obviously the Labour and the Conservatives in Britain have been dominant in politics for a very long time there. So they have somewhere between America's dominance by two parties and Israel's parliamentary system. But it's less stability and it does create a fair bit of turnover and a feeling that every policy could be the end of the government. I think in order for you to have a thriving society, you do need predictability in law. Parliamentary systems tend to create less predictability in law.
I do have to say I'm a big fan of the British parliamentary system just because they like shout.
Well, yeah, that's different.
They're like, here,
so that part, so that's
like
pretty
the
great.
Rules.
Well, yeah, the parliament sessions, the House sessions where the prime minister comes and then gets yelled at by people
is just
fantastic.
Amazing. It's amazing. I wish.
Oh, man. Can you imagine? Trump would be amazing at that. Can you imagine that? He comes down and Bernie Sanders is like, "Mr. President, you had sex with a porn star." And Trump is like, "I don't care."
And then everybody's shouting and cheering.
Right, exactly.
I feel like that's the way it was meant to be.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only thing I would change about
our
system.
Also, they should shift the center of government in the United States. I saw this suggestion on Twitter to Phoenix. They should move it out of D.C. D.C.'s too nice. They should be in like a real... Phoenix is nice too. Maybe not Phoenix.
You caught
maybe
they should there.
Maybe not Phoenix.
Detroit.
I like Phoenix. Yeah, they should move to like downtown Detroit, like or like the crappy area of Detroit. They should move to like right like off 8 Mile. We should like settle it right in 8 Mile, and then
Yay, I silenced you. Isaac says, "Hi Ben." Oh, I wonder if he used his real name. Isaac says, "Hi Ben. I'm proposing to my girlfriend. Do you have any good advice for us?"
So my advice is that you make sure, number one, make sure that your values align. Mm-hmm. I mean, I assume that if you're proposing, then your values align. Beyond that, I think that you should I have many pieces of advice, so it's hard to boil this down.
Are you going to write a book on relationship advice?
At some point, I might. I mean, I've been married almost 10 years, and I feel like my relationship with my wife is pretty spectacular.
Well, and you recently were asked at one of your college campus speeches.
About dating, yeah.
About dating.
That's true.
And I think, like, what you had to say about values was good.
I have money advice. I have relationship advice. I would say you need to actually take time out with your spouse. Okay, she's your girlfriend now, but once you get married, you're going to be distracted with other things because people have a natural tendency to feel that once they're locked in, they don't have to do the work anymore. Well, you actually have to do work in your relationship. That's fun, right? Meaning, like, take some time with your spouse, go out and do something fun. And this takes me to money advice when it comes to young couples particularly. You can live like a rich person without actually being rich. The stuff that's going to make you poor is not going to the movies once a week. The stuff that's going to make you poor is buying a houseboat, right? It's going to be big purchases that bankrupt you. You can save up. But it's better, like, really, if you go to the movies once a week and go to ice cream once a week and eat at home the rest of the time, you're going to feel a lot wealthier than if you go to a restaurant four times a week and go bankrupt. Like, just there are certain small things you can do that make you feel like you have a life. And I think that it's important to feel like that, particularly when you're young. Also, make sure that you are ready for the responsibility of having children before you have children. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that that's controversial in some religious circles just because some people are pro-birth control, some people are anti-birth control. I am not anti-birth control. I'll get in trouble with some of my more religious friends for saying that, but I'm not anti-birth control because I think that people should be responsible about how and when they have children. That said, you know, obviously every child is a gift. So it's, but I think that, you know, providing a stable home for your child is the best thing. Make sure that you've worked on yourself and yourselves as a couple before you have kids, because it's an additional burden, okay? It does change things. I mean, Alicia knows she has young kids also. I mean, it changes things radically once you have babies, right?
Your relationship, everything becomes self-sacrificial.
Yes.
Like, if marriage already
seems sacrificial
to you. The
last time you looked at your husband right? I mean, like that.
Early this morning when I left and everyone was sleeping in my bed.
Oh, right, exactly. Like that's,
and it was so cute.
But like the last time you actually looked into your husband's eyes was probably before your first child was born. I mean, that's sort of how it is once you get married. And it'll be like that for the next, you know, 25 years. So you better be on solid footing before you have the kids, because otherwise it gets dicey.
Grace says, as a conservative, how do you suggest we balance national security and individual privacy? Obviously, this is a big discussion post 9/11 and the Patriot Act. Right.
So I think that the big question is, what can government do in targeted fashion not to invade your privacy? What we've tended to do is do these broad swath security measures that do invade huge, huge portions of privacy for people because we are afraid of, quote unquote, being discriminatory or of targeting people. Okay, targeting profiles of people is not the same. Description of a suspect is not the same as racial profiling, for example. And so searching in areas where you know the criminals are more likely to be does not amount to racial profiling. The same holds true with regard to national security. I tend to lean libertarian on the national security side. I don't know how much information gathering the federal government actually needs to do versus how much they say they need to do, because why the hell not? No one's going to stop them. And I have been troubled by some of the FISA abuses that we've seen over the past, you know, 15 years since the Patriot Act.
Okay, we are almost done. I think we're almost done. We are wrapping up, and it's going to be, I mean, it's just flown by here. Joey says, Ben Shapiro, I love that he used your last name, I asked the right Ben. What is a non-religious argument against euthanasia?
The non-religious argument against euthanasia is that once you have doctors who have become licensed killers, there are two arguments. One is licensed killers get paid to kill people. Mm-hmm. So that means they don't really have a medical interest in telling people not to die. Mm-hmm. Right? So if you're going to get paid $10,000 per euthanasia, for example, and somebody calls up and they're in depression, they're in the throes of depression, and they say, I want you to kill me. And you say, well, let's see, I could either convince you not to do that, or I could take the 10 grand and run. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I don't take it, some other guy's going to take it. Then you are creating a market for death, which I think is a serious problem. And the other problem that I think that you're creating here is the problem that you've seen in some of the Nordic countries with regard to euthanasia, which is the extension of euthanasia to people who are not terminally ill. Now, one of the things that people have said about euthanasia is, well, whose business is it of yours if I want to die? Well, if that's your principle, then presumably anybody who wants to kill themselves for any purpose should be able to have the assistance of a doctor in doing that. I think most people don't agree with that, right? And I think there's a reason they don't agree with that, which is it's morally abhorrent. You broke up with your girlfriend, and now you feel depressed. And if you just hang on for another week, you'll be fine, right? Most people would not be okay with, okay, I'm going to call up Doc, and he's going to come over here and shoot me up with some lethal concoction. I think most people would not be happy with that for a reason. But once you say that the person has full autonomy to commit suicide, then the question becomes, where do you draw the line? And so people on the left will try to draw the line at terminal illness, but then the question becomes, well, why are you supplanting your own judgment for the person who wants to commit suicide? And as you see, this actually tends to degrade toward people should be able to commit suicide whenever they want with the help of a doctor.
Nape asks, what do you think of the idea of the Navy SEALs and the Army Delta Force assassinating gangs, cartels, organized crime syndicates, untouchable criminal leaders, et cetera, in the U.S. extrajudicially.
So, I mean, the idea here is that obviously American citizens are guaranteed due process of law. This is not true if you're an imminent threat to life, right? So if somebody is chasing a guy down the street and he's about to kill him, you can shoot him. You don't have to wait for him to kill the guy and then you drag him in before a judge. So extrajudicial killing in the United States, as you know, anywhere else, I mean, this is actually an issue for American citizens abroad too, is no good unless you're talking about an imminent threat to life, life and limb for somebody else.
David says, hi, Ben. What do you think the chances are that Republicans try to primary Trump in 2020? Also, what do you think it would take for Republicans to start collectively turning on him?
Okay, so number one, you know, I hope that Trump does so well that nobody has to turn on him. I think that would be great. As far as primarying him, I think the chances are very strong. Somebody like John Kasich or Jeff Flake decides to primary Trump simply out of some sort of misguided egotism. It'll go nowhere. It'll be a complete fail. And I think all it will do is actually completely divide the party even further than it's already been divided. Trump is the president. Trump's running for re-election. The chances of somebody successfully primarying him are extraordinarily low, barring some sort of cataclysmic circumstance between now and 2020. In order for Republicans to, quote unquote, turn on Trump, it depends. I mean, are we talking about not support any of his agenda? Mm-hmm. I think the answer is nothing can happen because some of his agenda is worth supporting. This is one of the weird things Democrats have been saying. Well, you don't like what Trump said about Charlottesville, but you supported his tax cuts. And it's like, right, because I liked his tax cuts, but I didn't like what he said about Charlottesville. I'm confused. Is it a package deal? If the idea is, when will people say they will not vote for Trump for re-election? I think there are a number of things that he could do that we wouldn't want to vote for him for re-election. If the economy crashes, I think a lot of Republicans will sign off. I think that if he says, you know, more deeply immoral things and alienates, let's say that President Trump paid for an abortion or something, right? I think that would turn off a lot of people. Or if the president came out and embraced abortion on demand, I think that would turn off a lot of people. If the president tried gun confiscation, there are certain red lines that Republicans can't cross. And I think that that if Trump crosses those red lines, it'll be a problem for him. I don't think he will, by the way.
Derek says, what's the best kind of Girl Scout cookies?
Oh,
this is the most important question.
So give me, you know all the kinds, right?
Yeah. Okay. So it's like Do-Si-Dough, Samoas, Tagalongs, Thin Mints, the best in the freezer. What are some of the other ones?
So,
there's like a lemon one that's just crap. I mean, if we're being honest.
So I'm really dull. I kind of like, if I'm not mistaken, they have like the shortbread cookies, right?
Okay, yeah.
I like the shortbread.
What's the name of the shortbread one?
I think they're, if they are kosher, then I like those. And if they're not kosher, then I like the equivalent of those. And so,
I think all Girl Scout cookies are kosher, though.
I think they are, but I'm not sure about the marshmallow ones. I'll check.
S'mores.
Yeah.
S'mores. Marketing department is a fan of the s'mores.
Okay.
There have been too many Girl Scout cookies hanging around this office. It is not helpful.
I have a joke right now, I won't say.
Okay. James Jackson says, hey, Ben, what's your views on the UK's ban on hate speech and the recent detention of journalists like Lauren Southern trying to enter the UK?
I mean, obviously, this is utter crap. You know, put Lauren Southern aside for a second.
Pamela Geller is another one,
Yeah,
too.
Exactly. The banning people from entering countries because they said things that you found offensive is a very good way to ensure that their views get a wider hearing than if you had not banned them at all. It's really, really stupid. It's the equivalent of saying, Richard Spencer can't come speak on my campus because if he speaks on my campus, all the Nazis will show up. And then he goes and one guy shows up. Whereas if you make a fuss, then everybody shows up and you make a cause celeb of him. I think this is really, really dumb. And again, the problem with hate speech is it's a completely malleable term. It's a legal term of art that has no real definition.
So that was our last question.
Ooh, we can go home.
We can go home now. I can go feed the baby. You can go write something. I don't know.
Yeah.
How fast do you type?
Last I checked, 133 words a minute.
Okay. So your book will be out next month?
Yeah, exactly.
Your book with relationship, financial, and children advice?
Yeah, exactly. That one's next on the table.
That is all for today, folks. Thanks for joining us, everyone. And don't forget, you can still subscribe to DailyWire.com now and join us for next month's episode of The Conversation featuring Andrew Klavan on Tuesday, April 10th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific. Well, I will see you then. I'm Elisha Cross, your host, and thanks so much, Ben, for being here.